Great. I'm going to get my technology sorted in a moment, but it's really it's great to be over here. Came over the hills this morning. There was a sale going on of sheep, so there's a lot of sheep being transported on the A59 this morning. But coming over the hills this morning, I don't often come across to Yorkshire. And because I'm from Liverpool myself, it did remind me, I don't know if anyone else remembers the story, of when the chap, Mick from Liverpool and George from Yorkshire, they were involved in a terrible car accident. And both of them, you know, they were soon waiting there at the pearly gates. And St. Peter was there. And and so the two of them go up and... George from Yorkshire went first, and St. Peter said, "Who are you?" And he said, "Oh, I'm George, actually from Harrogate." And suddenly, all these fireworks went off. These angels were coming down, picked up George, and flew him into heaven. Pretty good. So Mick from Liverpool then goes up and says, "Yeah, hi, Pete. You know, who are you? I'm Mick from Liverpool." And St. Peter says, "Okay, you're in." And, you know, Mick sort of, he said, "Look, Pete, I don't want to cause trouble on the first day. Us Scousers have a reputation, you know. I don't want to cause trouble on the first day, but, you know, what was with all the flags and the fireworks for the guy from Harrogate?" And he said, "Oh, you've got to understand, Mick. We have thousands of people from Liverpool here. First one from Harrogate for years." Right, let's get... and it'll go downhill from there, I'm afraid. OK, so just while I set this up, I've got a question for you at the start of the handout there. It'll come up on the screen in a minute, but on the start of the handout, quick question to get us going. And that is... what does it mean to say that we meet Jesus today? How do you personally meet Jesus? How do you hope or help other people to meet him? It's not a trick question, but it's very easy. I've got another book there called Meeting Jesus. We're going to talk about Jesus encountering people, and it's very easy to use that language about meeting. And I just want you to ponder, maybe talk to your neighbour for a moment. Actually, how is that real for you? I mean, somebody might, you know, talk about worship, talk about the Bible, talk about nature, whatever. But that language of meeting or encountering God, encountering Jesus, what does that actually mean for you? So talk to your neighbours while I get this set up. That's the easy one to start with. Okay, folks, if I can bring you back together... Okay, so my topic for today, there we are. Today is the day for everyone, growing church in Luke and Acts. And this word today is going to come up a bit. And what this is about is, if you've never thought about it before, in most of the Gospels, what we have is Jesus going around meeting people. That's how it works. And if you're more into scholarly stuff, and you know that there are that there's other gospels, there's other Christian texts talking about Jesus, the big difference between all of them and the ones in the Bible is other things go around giving Jesus teaching, but in our gospels in the Bible, the gospels that God has given us, Jesus goes around meeting people. That's what the gospels are about. And when we read the Gospels, what we do is piggyback on that experience and meet God as we read. So there's so much in our Gospels about meeting Jesus, hearing stories of Jesus meeting people. But when you think to start with about the Gospels and about the Christian faith, we have this problem that we can't meet Jesus in the way that they did. Yeah. And many of us think about that at different times of our life, that if we could sort of listen to him, hold on to him, share a meal with him, it would be different. And you get that sense, don't you? After Jesus' resurrection, there's then that sense that the promise that he will come back. So we will all finally meet him. But what are we doing in the meantime? And what, when I was asked to talk maybe about Luke's gospel and think about Luke and Acts, the thing I wanted to share with you really is that Luke and on into the book of Acts does something very, very clever. And it takes all of this language about meeting Jesus and about Jesus' return even and says, let's forget all of that chronological time. The only time that matters is today, is now, is this moment when you can respond to God. If you think about the beginning of Acts, they say, oh, what are the times? When are you going to come and restore the kingdom? And Jesus says, nah, we're not having that conversation. Yes, one day I'll come back. But the question is, we can continue to have this today moment, this moment of now. If you have ears to hear, then hear. Now, today is the moment. So that's almost a brief summary of what I'm going to do. And I want to show you this. And as we go through the first part of my talk, go through some of Luke's gospel to say, we're not caught in a world where we're wondering why Jesus hasn't returned. We're not caught in a world of thinking back to, oh, wouldn't it have been good if we had been there at the time? That the issue Jesus brings to us is today, what are you going to do? At the end of this bit of this part of my talk, I'm going to ask you that question. What is today the day for? For you. So, today is the day. Luke, the same author, Luke is the author of the book of Acts as well. He creates this great story for us, which focuses, I don't care where you are in the world. I don't care if you're a Jew or a Gentile, a woman or a man. I don't care whether you're a Greek or a Jew. Today is the day. And we will come back to my picture. A little bit has been said about me, better the devil you know. There we are, I'm shaking hands with you. So church in Wales now, looking after education and training there. And as was said, being a vicar and New Testament stuff and all the rest. So here we go. I might even have some music. Is my music going to play? No. That's a shame, isn't it? Okay. This spiritual, people get ready. There's a train coming. You don't need no baggage, just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the diesel coming. You don't need no ticket. Just thank the Lord. Luke talks about people forcing their way into the kingdom of God. Get ready. Just get on board. And so I'm going to spiral us, first of all, and we get to the first Bible passage here, to what is the most fun Bible passage in the New Testament, certainly the most fun parable. And it's fun because you can sit there. It was in the lectionary for those in those sorts of churches. It was in the lectionary a couple of weeks ago. And you'll have had that three-yearly moment of joy of seeing the vicar trying to say black is white, white is black, stand on his head to tell you the passage doesn't mean what it obviously does mean. So here we go, the favourite bit of, and this is why we have New Testament scholars, isn't it? We are paid to make the passages not say what they obviously mean because we don't like them. I mean, that's what the whole biblical scholarship is about. So here we are. What have we got here? And this is where we'll start, and you'll start to see maybe there's a little bit of truth in what I'm saying. Jesus says to his disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager who denounced him for squandering possessions. So he summoned him and said, what is this I hear about you? Hand over your management records, for you can be my manager no longer. Now, that makes sense. That makes sense, doesn't it? If you're the IT chap, and you've been doing things you shouldn't do, the managing director calls you in, and he says, hand over the passwords for the mainframe and the data store, thank you very much. You're out. So the manager says to himself, oh, what am I going to do now? As my manager is taking the management away from me. I don't have the strength to dig. I'm too ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do so that when I have been dismissed as manager, people will welcome me into their homes. So summoning each one of his master's creditors, he said to the first, how much do you owe my master? He said, 100 drums of olive oil. He said to him, take your contract, sit down quickly, make it 50. Then he said to another man, how much do you owe? He replied, 100 bags of wheat. He told him, take your contract, make it 80. This manager is bonkers. If you've just decided to sack the IT chap, you don't let him stay in his office for the next 2 days, deleting the data and changing the passwords, do you? If you're going to sack the manager, if the master is sacking the manager, you don't give him all this time to change the contracts. Or at least we wouldn't do, would we? But God is not like us. The parables do not tell you stories about how we behave, because they're telling us about God, aren't they? And God is not like us. So the story goes on. The master praised the dishonest manager because he had acted sensibly. For the worldly are more sensible than the godly in responding to their moment in history. I tell you, use your dishonest wealth to make your friends for yourself, so that when it is gone, you'll be welcomed into eternal homes. It's a bizarre story. It's a story of a master who knows the chap is wicked, who knows he's for the chop, and gives him this bizarre window of opportunity that no sensible human would give. And it's a story of the wicked man who sees that the game is up and does something. And Jesus praises him because when he saw that the game was up, he responded. He did something. Seize the moment. The context where Jesus is telling this parable, if you look back at Luke 15, 1 to 2, the Pharisees and the scribes are grumbling at Jesus because he welcomes the sinners. And so Jesus tells our parable, it goes back to our picture of our train. He tells this parable and effectively he says to them, look, I come and I talk about God, and all you religious people over here say, oh, very interesting. Well, should we have some exegesis of Isaiah next week, please? We'd like to hear some more from you. And the wicked people over here, sorry, guys, the wicked people over here just say yes. The game is up. The chance to meet God, to come to God, has come. The godly keep talking. The wicked seize the moment. And so we see two things in that parable. We see two things. One is that God is not like us. God gives these people this final chance. Even if it's a final chance, it affected fiddle of books. When the axe should fall, God delays the axe falling to give you a chance to respond. And the wicked, they don't care about tickets. They're just going to get on board while the godly keep talking. Seize the moment. Something is happening in the New Testament. Something is happening. You see it in all of the Gospels. It's very clearly in Luke's Gospel. Luke says, just after this parable of the dishonest manager, Luke says, until John, it was the law and the prophets. Since then, The good news of the kingdom of God is being proclaimed, and all are forcing their way in. Something different is happening in Jesus' ministry. Something different is happening. What is new? We see a little bit more in this passage from Luke chapter 7. Jesus says, "To what then can I compare the people of this generation?" Yeah. The now people, the people who are here today, out there on the street, there in the 17th century, there in the first century. What do we do with the people of this generation? What are they like? They're like children sitting in the marketplace and calling out to each other, "We played the dirge, the pipe for you, and you didn't dance. We sang a dirge, and you didn't cry. You can't win." Yeah? Be happy and jolly, they don't like it. Be sad and mournful, they don't like it. "John the Baptist came neither eating bread nor drinking wine, and you said he had a demon. The Son of Man, Jesus, came eating and drinking, and you said he's a glutton and a drunkard and a friend of tax collectors and sinners. But wisdom is proved right by all her children." Jesus and John were both doing God's work. But they were doing something different. Until John, it was one thing from God. Since then, with Jesus, it's something different, also from God. Both operating from God, but a different mission, a different mode of operation. Someone once drew me a picture, I should have scanned it and put it up on the screen, but a picture of John, archetypal holy man, wizened, dry hair, a bit sunburnt, gaunt, you know, prophet, looks holy, talking about righteousness. Jesus, bit pasty, too many pies, too many parties. They look different. They're doing something different. The new situation is Jesus' presence. One of the parables that comes up in Matthew, Mark, and Luke about the bridegroom. You cannot make the wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them. The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away, then you can fast. But Jesus' presence, this creates a moment in history, but like I say, we're probably not talking about chronological time. Jesus' presence then, Jesus coming close to someone now, creates a different set of rules. It creates that imperative to just get on board. Seize the moment. And I just thought, in a note at the bottom there saying, see post-resurrection, you notice that sense of Jesus' presence. Sometimes people don't really quite grasp this. When Mary from Magdala sees Jesus in the garden and she realizes it's him, you know, the resurrection appearances, and Jesus calls her by name, what does she do? She grabs hold of him because he's been taken from her, and his presence makes all the difference. When Peter is fishing on the lake and there they are and they realize it's Jesus, what does he do? He jumps in the water and swims to the bank because Jesus' presence makes everything different. The people on the Emmaus Road, they talk to Jesus, they come in, and at the end of it, when they recognize him, they've had a long walk from Jerusalem, it's night, they jump up and run back and say, "We've seen the Lord." Because that encounter, that presence of Jesus makes all the difference. So just a moment, there might not be time to talk to your neighbors, maybe there is, 30 seconds. Everything is different when Jesus' presence is present. Is that right? Have a ponder. 20 seconds, I'll drink my glass of water. Okay, I'm going to carry on. Now, You've all been very kind so far and haven't actually said rubbish, but you're all sitting there thinking, yeah. So I'm going to try to persuade you this is even more true. Look at this parable again in Luke to say it is all about there being this window of opportunity, this moment that we saw in the dishonest manager. It's all about it. A man had a fig tree planted in his garden and he came looking for fruit on it and found none. So he said to the gardener, see here, for 3 years I've come looking for fruit on this fig tree, I find nothing. Cut it down. Judgment should come. Cut it down. Bring it to an end. Flood the world again. And he says, sir, let it alone for one more year. I'll dig around it, put manure on it, give it a final chance. If it bears fruit next year, well and good. If not, you can cut it down. When I was inducted as the vicar in Widnes, this was the passage the bishop chose to preach on, which I think did send a certain ripple of anxiety through the church. good old Bishop Bishop Richard. It's a fascinating picture, isn't it? It isn't a picture that says judgment, oh no, God doesn't do that sort of thing. You know, at the end it says, if it doesn't bear fruit, it'll be cut down. But it's a picture of this delay, this pause, this window of opportunity, in the sense for the tree. Now is its moment. It can have a final chance, just like our dishonest manager. There we are, Gerald finding the window of opportunity he'd been looking for all his life. It runs all the way through Luke's gospel, this sense that you have, your neighbour has a window of opportunity to respond. The beginning of Luke's gospel, Jesus says this. He says, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he's anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim release to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favour. I don't know if you've ever looked at the bit of the Old Testament he's quoting. He stops mid-sentence, the cheeky man. He stops mid-sentence. He doesn't say, and the day of vengeance of our God. There's a moment, the year of the Lord's favour. But when he arrives in Jerusalem, 3 years later, he says this. When he drew near, he saw the city, wept over it, saying, if you, even you, had only recognized on this day the things that made for peace, but now they're hidden from your eyes. Talks about the destruction that Jerusalem will face and explains this is because you didn't recognize the time of God coming to you, the time of your visitation, the time of your inspection. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me to proclaim the year of the Lord's favour. Are we ditching the last bit of Isaiah? We're not, actually, are we? Because a few years later, Jesus seems to be saying, now, you haven't heard. Of course, many people had heard, but in some sense, you haven't heard. And the rest of Isaiah will follow. Lots of references you could give in Luke about this, about the need to respond to the times, to see the times, to see the moment. Here in Luke 12, he says to the crowd, when you see a cloud rising in the west, immediately say it's going to rain. You live where I live, wherever you see a cloud, you know it's going to rain. If you can't see a cloud, it's already raining. But he said to the cloud, when you see a cloud rising in the west, you say it's going to rain. It does. The south wind blows, he says, it's going to be hot. It is. Hypocrites. You know how to interpret the appearance of the earth and the sky. How is it you don't know how to interpret the present time, the moment you're in? Seize the moment. This great opportunity of the year of the Lord's favour. And if you think about it, our poor ancestors there, the Jewish people in Jesus' day, if you read the Old Testament, you don't expect this. If you read the Old Testament, you expect the day of the Lord to come. If you read the Old Testament, what you don't expect is what you get, which is a chance to respond. God coming to save the wicked. Just get on board. This window of opportunity is the wonderful thing in Jesus. We do have to be a bit careful there. It isn't about some great scheme, although in that picture about Jerusalem, it's like Jesus saying, but you haven't heard. Of course, lots of people in Jerusalem had heard. And if you carry on in the book of Acts, you find lots more people in Jerusalem come to a faith in Jesus. So it isn't some great scheme of history going on. It seems to be played out in the life of individuals. Do you respond? Do you not? And that today word. Look at these references in Luke's gospel. When Jesus preaches in Capernaum there in Luke 4, today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. Today. We've seen things, strange things today. When Jesus threatened by Herod, he says, listen, I'm casting out demons and performing cures today and tomorrow. And on the third day, I finish my work. Now is the moment. Zacchaeus up his tree. Jesus was a one-day only special in Jericho. And what did Zacchaeus do? He seized his moment. And Jesus said to him, today I'm going to eat with you. Salvation has returned to this house. If Zacchaeus had, you know, been watching The Crown on telly, thought he'd go out the next day, he'd have missed it. That was the day. And he met Jesus. Jesus is only ever passing through. The thief on the cross. The thief on the cross. What does he do you say to Jesus? He turns to Jesus and Jesus says, today you'll be with me in paradise. That was the moment. I mean, talk about the dishonest manager. The thief on the cross, he was skin of his teeth, wasn't he? But when he had his moment, he seized it. And I think there's a pastoral and sort of missional truth to this. You can ponder over refreshments in a little. But I think when you think about people on the edges of church, people interested in the faith, people who come along, people don't remain in a state of being really, really interested for many months and years. People actually come to a point of decision in some way. And that doesn't mean that if they, at that point, can't face it, don't get it, too frightened, stay away. It doesn't mean that an opportunity won't come again. But it does seem, in my experience, that people come to points of decision. And that is the today moment for them. People come to these points of, am I going to jump in with God or am I not? And if for whatever reason they sadly think they can't face it, and they don't stay at that moment of on the edge for the next months. The moment fades away and passes them by. And we have to hope it comes around again. To go back to that verse, John, it was one thing. With Jesus, since then, everyone's forcing their way in. Jesus' arrival, Jesus' presence, creates a focus solely on responding and getting in. John, and everything before John, had done a good job of teaching people how to be righteous and holy if you were part of God's people. That's an important question. But Jesus isn't doing that. Jesus is going around helping the wicked get in. Think about the parable of the prodigal son. It's a Jesus parable. So it's all about that moment of the chap in the pigsty pigsty, realizing his moment, doesn't he? I am going to go back home. And how he is welcomed home. And they throw a party that day. The next day, presumably, he suddenly needed to stop his wild living and help with the harvest. But that's not the Jesus question. The Jesus question is about this chap turning round, responding, and coming home. We have this moment. Everyone has this moment. People get ready. Just get on board. You don't need a ticket. Just grab hold. And there, in a more modern song, there. Oh. There we are. We do have some music.
Casting my cares aside, I'm leaving my past behind. I'm setting my heart and mind on you, Jesus. I'm reaching my hand to yours, believing there's so much more. Knowing that all you have in store for me is good.
Today is the day. And so that sense of today is the day in our turning to God, but also, that's why I asked that question being about you meeting with God. That we still long for, don't we? Most of our life, most of our worship is orientated towards re-encounter, isn't it? In some way, many of us can see some sense of encountering God at the beginning of our Christian life. Not, I mean, I know for some people it's something dramatic. It isn't something dramatic for people like me, but nevertheless, there's a sense of becoming aware of God. And at the end of our life, we're going to meet God. And most of us spend all the time in between, you know, go off to spring harvest, climb a mountain. We're doing things to try to encounter that presence of God again. And so that today is the day. That sense, it is the today moment for Zacchaeus and the penitent thief. But also, every day we're wanting, today is the day when I respond to God. So I've got two questions for you here. You can go either way, and we'll have a few minutes to ponder these. So the first question, tricky in its own way. Do you naturally connect with John's mission of promoting righteousness? How should we live as God's people? Or Jesus' mission of welcoming the wicked? There's not a battle there, remember? The Holy Spirit is justified by all her children. You know, John and Jesus, both working for God, but different things. Jesus, the today moment, get these people on the train. John, how do we run this train successfully afterwards? Jesus, the son's come back, welcome him, throw a party. John, how do we now run the farm? Now, the I think we all just favour one of those. We all just favour one of those. Of course, just to reveal my true colours, of course, in the church, we tend to make all the senior people the John-type people, don't we? You know, oh, you can have a youth worker there who hangs around with the dodgy people, and you can do that. But like the vicar and the church wardens, they focus on, you know, maintaining righteousness. Of course, it's the other way around here, isn't it? Jesus is actually the senior guy, isn't he, compared to John? But that's me being cheeky. So, do you see any sense in my idea of the two different things going on? And if so, you know, do you warm towards one? Well, the other question would be, what is today the day for you? We can see it as the day when you meet with God for the first time, but are you sitting here thinking, actually, today is the day? Talk to your neighbours.
that I was in Jerusalem, and I'd miss my concert. Something's at least the best thing anywhere, the crowds of people everywhere, and things like that. So I didn't ever find my way around Jerusalem. And I couldn't see, you know, the lack of the things on my head. So it was get back to Christ.
Okay, folks. Now, to explain how we're going to go, I'm going to carry on a little bit more and move into Acts in a moment. We'll have coffee in a little bit, but it's always better to know you're on the downhill stretch before you get to your coffee, isn't it? And we're going to have a bit more time. We've got some discussions and some time for questions later as well. I don't want to press you on these two, but has anyone got any questions and queries that they'd like to voice now about anything I've been saying before? We're just going to carry on and see how some of this turns up in the book of Acts. But anyone want to voice anything now? Yes?
Just to say, I've worked on interfaith relations a lot.
Certainly. So a friend here is saying that having worked in interfaith relations of people coming to Christ from other world religions, that's normally a process involving quite a long time. And how does that fit with what I've been saying about today is the day? So that's the question. I don't want to, two things. First of all, I think when we talk about evangelism or mission, one of the issues is people always project that there's a way this should happen. And the way it should happen tends to be the way it happened to them. Not always, but there's often that sense. It's one of the problems with a lot of Christian biography and all of this. It sort of projects what is, you know, that this is somehow the model. And we're in a great age of anxiety now. If you talk to your vicar or the bishop or whatever, they all are obsessed with, you know, we've got to come up with the plan, you know? We have to have the mission plan, the strategic plan, the development plan. There must be a blueprint we can follow, and then it would work. It's the same in business. Every chief exec has to come up with the latest, you know, the new plan. So that's the first thing to say, that it's, I know you're not meaning it's a challenge, but it's an important corrective to say, look, I think I'm seeing something here about this today moment in Luke's gospel. But we have to be very clear and very careful that we're not sliding into saying there is a blueprint of the method by which people come to faith. And I suppose that was my question in the beginning. How do you encounter Jesus? And if we had taken the poll on that, there would have been a lot of different things, wouldn't there? However, secondly, and I think, you know, more directly in response to the question, I would still want to suggest that I suppose in traditional terms of people coming to a moment of choice, a moment of decision. And so it's one of the interesting things when you look at Jesus' mission. Jesus almost exclusively went to Jewish people, didn't he? He went to people who knew the story. And the people he particularly seemed to go to were the people who knew the story and felt they were excluded from it. The traitors, the sex workers, the people who were on the edge, who thought their identity as being part of the people of Israel had been lost. And so they knew the story, and so for them, there was this calling back. And it reminds me, although it's before my time, but it reminds me when you look at the history, say, of Billy Graham missions, the first one was in the 50s, wasn't it? Particularly with that one, and maybe even with the 84 one. This was preaching to people who fundamentally knew the Christian story and had experienced some elements of church. And so they could have, in a sense, what I've been highlighting, the today moment, the moment of saying, well, are you going to come up to the front? Are you going to respond? Because you know the story, you know what it's about. And I think what the question highlights, and actually is an issue for us today so much, we're talking to people who don't know the story. And therefore, I still think, on the whole, people do get to a point where they they were spot. I mean, quite a few people, you know, from certainly from Muslim background, see visions of Jesus, have dreams of Jesus. People meet you and do have a moment of response, but it is clearly built on a huge amount of developing the understanding and learning, and then there's still a moment of commitment. And that's not what people had to do in Jesus' day. It is more like we might see them having to do in the early church when they're preaching to Gentiles who have got no idea at all of any of the basis of the faith. And I think more today, not really with young people my age and under, again, we're in a world where they don't have that background. So does that sort of at least go some way to saying, so there's the background and there's the moment? Okay, I'm going to keep on going and more questions later. I want to talk about breaking boundaries, giving up what is precious, which is my way of talking about what the book of Acts is about. So the starter for you, if someone who had never been in church came into your church, what would they notice was different from general English or Yorkshire culture? So what things about how we do it here seem out of place compared to going into any of the other buildings on Leeds Road? Just to give you a starter, this has not been true this morning, and I have no idea whether it's true about this particular church, so forgive me if I'm getting at people, but how I was brought up was that when you went to someone's house, what happens? They say, would you like a drink? It's the bane of vicars' lives when you're 6 mugs of tea down and it's only 10:30 in the morning. But that's what we do, isn't it? If someone comes into the house, you ask them to want a drink. Not with the church. They're worried that if you have the drink, you then won't stay for the service, do you? You only get your drink after the service in church. Now, I'm not necessarily trying to say that's good or bad, but it's weird. It's not how the rest of our culture operates. So what else are people going to notice is strange if they've never been to church before compared to normal English culture when they come in to church? Talk to your neighbour. Okay, folks. We just come together. My last place was a typical Victorian church with, you know, wooden, you know, vicar's pews and all of that, which the people in the church carefully polished, you know, also polished wood at the front. And I remember very much, this is a very rundown area, and I very much remember when Jeff came to faith, and after a month he said to me, he always found coming into the church building difficult. And I said, oh, why is that, Jeff? And he says, well, with all those people and all the polished wood, it just reminds me of every time I was in court. Very intriguing that for him, the architecture just looked like court. Okay. We're going to come back around to those questions in a minute. I'm going to let you have your tea and coffee to fortify yourself in a moment when we have to get into those questions again. I just want to say, if you never thought about the Book of Acts, what have we got? Unlike the Gospels, where we have 4 versions, God's given us 4 portraits of Jesus. The Book of Acts, we only have 1. So the Book of Acts does become the dominant single narrative of how the growth of the church happened, the early development of the church. It presents a unity between the apostles, doesn't it? They come together, key moments. And that scholars, and to some extent, is, you know, fair enough, are seeing different emphases in the letters and the like. But the Book of Acts gives this sense of, okay, but when you look at the big picture, there is this going forward together. It encourages us to place letters like James and Peter and Paul's letters into this big story, doesn't it? So this gives us the framework into which we slot everything else. Powerful, it's memorable. But what was it for? What was it for? When I started trying to think about this, I wanted to say, okay, can I think of a way of what's it for, which actually explains what's in it? That sounds a fair way of doing it, doesn't it? So rather than me as a scholar projecting onto it what I think it's for, let's actually have an explanation, what's it for, which is based on what's in it, not just my favourite stories. Because all of us have the favourite stories from Acts. They're normally all the same. It's the Philippian jailer. It's a few of those stories in one particular bit of Acts. But when you look at the whole of Acts, it fits, I think, fairly straightforwardly. If you don't try to be clever and just chop it up by the number of words and find the middle bit, it actually has four bits to it, four quarters, very straightforwardly. You've got the church in Jerusalem for the first quarter. Then you've got the expansion of the boundaries for the next quarter, where the preaching goes to the Ethiopian eunuch and to the Sumerians and to the preaching with the Gentiles. And then they have the big discussion as to whether that is correct or not at the Council of Jerusalem. We then have the third quarter, all exact quarters, really, where Paul goes around doing all his mission. We like that bit. And then you have the final quarter. Golly, it's almost impossible to read. You just have the defence of Paul's mission in front of one Roman governor, followed in the next chapter by the defence of Paul's mission in front of another Roman governor. And guess what you get in the next chapter? The defence of Paul's mission in front of the Jewish king. The last quarter of the book, Paul is on trial. You then have a little bit of an interlude in chapter 27 where we can have a nice sea voyage to get Paul to where he's next on trial. So what is this about? The midpoint of all of that is this discussion in Acts 15 to say, is the expansion of the boundaries correct? Is this God's will? And all of those trials of Paul, that last quarter, are all trying him for whether the mission to the Gentiles was God's will or not. That's the question in all of Paul's trials. So the whole thing is constructed on this story about, is this entry of the Gentiles into the church God's will? And in a sense, Acts tells you that it is. So if you're Theophilus sitting there, the book is written to, if you're Theophilus sitting there in your vineyard in Naples, and you think, what on earth has this Jewish story got to do with me? I'm a Greek-speaking Italian Gentile living in Naples. And the book of Acts tells you how it got to you, and the fact that the Jewish God loves and cares for you and is on your side is true. Because it does sound a bit weird, particularly in the Roman world of different national gods. So the whole story is about demonstrating that God was behind the entry of the Gentiles. And that's why you have the big, you know, twice we hear Peter having his vision, you know, the sheet coming down. We get it twice because it's so important. But the argument is not normally, very, very rarely, is it about whether Gentiles are allowed to turn to Jesus. People don't actually have a problem with that. The question is whether they can come to Jesus and remain Gentiles, or put the other way around, when they come to Jesus, do they need to take on Jewish practices? That is the big issue in the book of Acts. Fine, come to Jesus, but basically you have to become Jewish or take on at least Jewish practices in the way, in the process. And this is what we have there in Acts chapter 15. It's there in full on your handout. I've extracted the bits here. The people come up, some of the believers, so followers of Jesus, but from a Pharisee background, say, the Gentiles must be circumcised and required to obey the law of Moses. These are the Gentiles who are coming to Jesus, the Gentiles who have heard Paul's preaching, God's Spirit has come upon them, and they're saying, great, this is wonderful, but no ham sandwiches on the church buffet. Yeah? They need to follow God's practices as laid down in the Old Testament. Circumcision, slightly more painful subject, but that same thing. And the apostles and the elders, it's depicted as everyone together saying, no, no. They then come up with an interesting compromise at the end there in verse 19. Having said no, they do not need to become follow Jewish practices. They then say, we should not make it difficult for the Gentiles to turn to God. What we want is the Gentiles to turn to God. Let's not make it difficult by saying you need to follow certain Jewish practices. But they do need to do a few things. And this list has fascinated scholars ever since. Abstain from food polluted by idols, from sexual immorality, from the meat of strangled animals, and from blood. Scholars have all sorts of ways of trying to explain these. Do they go back to Noah? Are they? Or is this in some sense, I might say at a simplistic level, not knocking the fact there may be more complicated answers, but a simplistic level, this almost looks like, no, you don't need, it's almost, you Gentiles over here, look. You don't need to follow Jewish practices. But, folks, our Jewish believers in Jesus over here, they are just going to find some things really hard. So look, you don't need to follow Jewish practices, but could you just avoid doing these things that are going to just be so offending these people? So that's what it looks like to me, is this sense of you don't need to, but hey, we have to find some way of living together. So there's a sort of don't push it. This is shocking. This is shocking. Well, we read this and think, you know, to be honest, most of us think, well, all our food law stuff is a bit strange anyway. So, you know, this makes sense to us, doesn't it? But this is shocking because the Jewish story had just worked. God had sent his Messiah. Yeah? All of the hopes of the Jewish story of the Old Testament had worked. This was the moment where God had proved the promises to Abraham through Israel were correct. So this is the high point. You know, this isn't the church with 20 people in it and the hole in the roof deciding they're going to do mission differently. This is the church which is absolutely crammed full of people saying, oh, we need to change. Huh? We always change when things are tough. This is, the church has worked, and they're saying, what do we do? And because the Jewish practices that were being talked about were explicitly commanded by God in the Old Testament. Yeah? We may at times think, you know, there'd been a building up of tradition or whatever. But Genesis 17 is fairly clear about the requirement of circumcision. Yeah? For man. So the thing for you to think about, just as we go for coffee, and then I'm going to push this a bit more about what does this mean for our churches. But we're going to have a break maybe till past 1:30. It's just you might want to think, how would that, if you're the Jewish believers, and they're coming back saying, no, actually, let's not bother doing these Jewish practices anymore. They don't need to do them. How would that make you feel? Let's have a cup of coffee. We'll start again about 1:30.